a look at the 27 Club. A lot of major rock stars, from Jim Morrison to Amy Winehouse, died at the age of 27. Our next guest set out to tell some of their stories.
Howard Soons joins us now. He's a biographer. His new book is 27, a history of the 27 Club through the lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. Howard, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we get into some of the individual stories, what are some of the common themes, the things you kept running up against as you looked into the lives of these artists who died at age 27?
Yes, well, I wanted to see if there was anything beyond a coincidence of so many famous people dying at the same age. And what I found was that they had many common factors in their lives, starting with troubled childhoods, which was a rocky beginning in life, and the problems start there and build, which explains their early demise.
And then there's that almost a stereotype or cliche of the hard-living, drug- and alcohol-fueled rock and roll lifestyle. Is that something also that in all six of these cases came up?
Yeah, but these aren't people who are drinking and taking drugs to have a good time. They're taking drink and drugs because they're basically desperately unhappy and psychologically flawed, people with on the border of mental illness, some more than others. But with Amy Winehouse, for instance, Janis Joplin as well, these are people with really deep psychological problems. And so they drank and they took drugs to get away from themselves, escape their problems, escape themselves. And this led to a sort of downward path of self-destruction. That's part of the story.
And then all of themselves found them in a scene where, A, they had the money for alcohol and drugs, but also they had ready access to anything they could get their hands on.
Yeah, well, of course, singers work in an environment, especially when they start their careers, when they're young, before they make it. They start in bars, and that's where you buy booze and where you buy drugs. But, of course, the money side of it doesn't really make any difference. You don't need a lot of money to buy a bottle of booze or to buy some heroin. The problems are really deep-rooted and start before they're famous, before anyone knows who they are, before they're millionaires. It starts when they're kids. They're unhappy kids. They become troubled adolescents. They start abusing drink and drugs as part of that troubled adolescence. And then they become suddenly, overwhelmingly famous overnight and don't cope well with it. They're not people who are psychologically strong in the first place, and they don't cope well with success.
Is that the difference between the people you write about in this book and the many, many rock stars who, you know, we know about their drug days and their hard lifestyles, but they're still with us? When they went into it, they were at this psychological disadvantage in a way.
I think so. I mean, a very good example of that is Mick Jagger and Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. And many people will forget that, in fact, the Rolling Stones was founded by Brian Jones, the guy with the yellow hair who played the guitar in the band before Ronnie Wood joined the band. So it was Brian's band, but Brian was a neurotic, unhappy, mixed-up guy and destroyed himself and then died this ridiculous sort of accidental death when he went swimming in the middle of the night when he was drunk, when he'd been taking pills. Now, he wasn't a strong guy psychologically. He wasn't cut out for fame, as Mick Jagger has observed. But Mick and Keith, despite all the debauchery, the high living, the hedonism, they are strong characters, and they've coped well, and they've enjoyed their fame. They've enjoyed being famous. But it was all a bit too much for Brian, and it was certainly too much for Amy and Janis and many of the others.
Well, let's follow with Brian Jones, and we'll give a listen to Paint It Black. I think it's Brian Jones playing sitar here.
Yeah.
No more will my green seagull turn a deeper blue. I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
So, Brian Jones, talented guitarist, multi-instrumentalist. You tell the story, he wasn't happy with the direction the Rolling Stones went in. He wanted to be a blues cover band.
Well, yes, he was a blues purist. He was a white middle-class boy from Cheltenham in the west of England, from a very middle-class family. But he had that fascination with black working-class music, you know, a world away, music that he didn't know firsthand, but he knew through records. And he was a purist, and he wasn't a great songwriter. And so when the Stones took off in a different direction with Mick and Keith writing pop hits, he didn't really approve of that. He thought that was a bit beneath him. And, of course, there were frictions in the band, and he just didn't get along with the other guys, and that was part of his problems. Each of the six main stars in the book have slightly different stories, but you see a general similarity between the lives if you look at them in the whole.
Well, and his death, you said it was, people have described it as an accidental death, but it seems like, again, a common theme in the stories you tell is that these are people who are very much flirting with self-destruction, whether they're overtly trying to commit suicide, they're very much dancing on the brink of it.
Yeah, and many of them attempt suicide. I mean, Brian attempted suicide long before he actually died. And by his very behavior, by his abuse of drink and drugs, he was flirting with death. And he was hospitalized. There were many close shaves. And he often threatened suicide and attempted suicide. So the final death, although it is accidental, the way he drowned, you know, it's not a sensible thing to do, to go swimming in the middle of the night when you've been drinking and taking drugs. It's not a sensible thing to do. It's a reckless thing to do. And it's the sort of stupid thing that he would have done that might well have ended fatally. And look at Jimi Hendrix, the next of the big six. Well, he also died accidentally by taking too many sleeping tablets, but he took 9 pills when half a pill would have been enough to put him to sleep for the night on top of drinking. Well, this is reckless behavior, you know, beyond what is reasonable.
Let's give a little listen to Jimi Hendrix now, Purple Haze. So I picked a clip featuring his singing there. Probably should have picked something featuring his guitar playing more so. But did he start in the same way that Brian Jones and the others did, a rocky lifestyle from the word go?
Well, an unhappy childhood. His father wasn't a very nice guy, and his parents, you know, it wasn't a stable relationship. The parents broke up. They were very, very poor, so he has this difficult childhood. And often, you know, the parents of the 27s are part of the problem. And Jimi Hendrix's dad didn't approve of him trying to become a musician and wasn't at all helpful or supportive. And so Jimmy, you know, joined the army to get away from dad. So that was part of the story of his early life. Often you'll find the 27s are in conflict with their parents, or the parents divorce when they're at an impressionable age, which was true of Jimmy and Amy and Kurt Cobain. And this destabilizes them, you know, as kids.
I want to visit one more before we take a break. We won't stick with chronology here. Let's check out Amy Winehouse in Rehab.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
So really just tragic there. I mean, she's openly acknowledging this conflict over drugs and alcohol that ultimately killed her. Talk about, you spend a fair amount of time coming back to that song through the book. Talk about that and where she was.
Well, she got into heroin and crack cocaine, which was obviously a great problem. And her family tried to get her to go to rehab, as she sings in the song. She's singing about her own life. It's directly autobiographical. But she wasn't somebody who wanted to submit to therapy. And so she never really engaged with therapy or psychologists or people who wanted to help her with her problems. She did eventually quit drugs, but she did so only by turning to alcohol. And she drank herself to death. I mean, I think many people forget this, that when she died, there were The police found three empty bottles of vodka in her bedroom, and she died alone, having been drinking alone, and drank herself to death. And doctors warned her, you know, that this wasn't a surprise. She was told in terms by her doctor the day before she died, if you continue to drink like this, Amy, you will die. And she'd been hospitalized for excessive drinking, as she had for her drug problem. And this is a long story, a long unhappy story that goes back a long, long way before she was famous. A story of sort of self-hatred, really, and misery, which she expresses so beautifully in her songs. I mean, she was a great songwriter, I think, and a wonderful singer, a really original talent, but a desperately unhappy person, and that's part of the music.
We're talking to Howard Soons about his new book, 27. It's about rock legends who died at age 27.
And you can join in the discussion, too. What are your thoughts on the so-called 27 Club? How might the music of these artists or their stories have changed if they would have lived longer? If you're a music fan, give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, and you can also post comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We pick up our conversation now with Howard Soons, author of 27. It's a book that looks at the lives of Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, and other rock legends who died at age 27. Give a listen to another one now, The Doors and Jim Morrison.
Please believe me, if you don't need me, I'm going, but I need a little time. I promised I would drown myself in mystic heated wine.
So, Howard, Jim Morrison talking about drowning himself in mystic heated wine, one of my favorite Doors songs there, actually. But he had thought about, I think, suicide, you mentioned in your book.
Yeah, a lot of these people talk about suicide. And the interesting thing about Jim Morrison is that he was an intellectual, and he read philosophy. And he kind of intellectualized his own life, and that was what the Doors were all about, really. And so in the last days in Paris, and of course his life ends in Paris in 1971, fascinating story, really, of his last days in France. He's talking about Nietzsche and what Nietzsche wrote about suicide, and Nietzsche can be interpreted as a sort of an advocate of suicide, even. There is this element, this sort of suicidal element to his behavior. We don't really know whether it was an accident when he overdosed in the Paris apartment or whether he meant to overdose, but the end result was the same. And like the others, he'd been going downhill for a long time.
So in reading your book, and I imagine in writing it, the big sense I get, in a selfish sense, is a sense of loss. Like, how much more great music did these people have in them that the world never got to hear?
Well, we'll never know that, of course. I think some of them had really dried up already. Amy hadn't created any new music of any note for several years and seemed to feel trapped by her image. And I think that was true of Jim Morrison. I think he'd outgrown this image as the Lizard King, this boy in leather pants, singing this rather pretentious music, much of it, I think. Perhaps Jimi Hendrix was the most talented of all of them, the most naturally gifted. And one can imagine Jimi Hendrix, he was talking about getting into jazz and playing with Miles Davis before he died. And he seemed to have more legs than the others. I can see him having a long career. But it seemed to me that many of the others had had enough. And they were weary of life, and they were weary of this career that they'd built and they'd become trapped in. And you can't imagine, can you, Kurt Cobain singing Smells Like Teen Spirit at age 50, and I can't imagine Janis Joplin at 70 bawling her lungs out, and I can't imagine Jim Morrison doing the Doors.
I want to argue with you. Johnny Cash, we just talked about him, and he had a period of drugs and self-destructiveness and came back in the 90s with some of the most powerful music he ever did. I mean, I would love to have had these guys have a chance to do that, even if they weren't just retreading their hits for years.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that many of these people, that their careers had already come to a halt and they felt trapped. They didn't like what they were doing. They didn't like the persona that they created. They hated who they had become. And I think that that's a different situation. Amy Winehouse, for instance, she sang about her own misery, and particularly the misery of a relationship with her first husband. That was the substance of that great album she made, Back to Black. Well, she got to the stage where she just didn't want to sing those songs anymore because it made her so unhappy, but she didn't have any new songs, and she didn't really know what she wanted to do. She really wanted to get married and have a family, but that option just didn't seem to, that didn't happen for her. So it seems to me that her career had stopped,
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Don in Milwaukee with us. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Great topic. Can't wait to read the book. But do you think it's just part of, like a self-indulgent kind of egotism of youth that, you know, drives these people to not see beyond maybe what they've accomplished or never accept themselves? And so the substance abuse problems, you drown yourself in alcohol, and, you know, Jim Morrison had a lot of songs about that, and Janis Joplin's notorious history with alcohol, and Amy Winehouse, that kind of played out, I think, in public for many years. Is that just kind of a self-indulgent egotism that just comes with being young and famous and very talented, and you get trapped by it?
Gotcha. Thanks, Don. What do you think, Howard?
Well, I think some of that is true. These are self-indulgent people, and of course they are spoiled. But I think more importantly, they're very unhappy people. They're people who are basically unhappy. So as I said at the beginning, they're not getting high for fun most of the time, although some of the time that was true. Towards the end, they're getting high because they're so deep down miserable. And you have to follow the trajectory of their lives, their short lives, to see that that's true, really. They've got really deep problems.
I wonder about the people around the 27 Club. Do you get a sense that there were a lot of people enabling this, overlooking the risk, the conflicts within these people?
Absolutely. The people around them are half the problem. And the reason why, one of the things we haven't mentioned is the reason that all these ridiculous conspiracy theories have grown up around these stars, these kind of mysteries about how they died exactly, part of the reason for that is that the people these stars were with at the end, notably Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix, the women they were with, were frankly completely dishonest. They were also drug users, and they concocted stories about the last hours of these men in order to evade questions about what they were up to. And this has created mystery where mystery doesn't need to exist. And often the families of these people were not particularly helpful. The stars didn't like their families. And yet the great irony, the great cosmic irony of it, is that when they die, the families become stupendously rich, which is something I detail in the last chapter of the book. The money that has accrued to the estates of these people after death is absolutely phenomenal, whereas most of them actually didn't make that much money in life.
We only have about a minute left. Do you get a sense in reading and writing about these musicians that there was a step in their lives where something could have gone different and they wouldn't have died young?
Yes. I think the thing they wished for, the thing that so many young people wish for, which is fame, and more so than ever these days, young people crave fame. They think that fame will somehow fill them up and make their lives worthwhile. What they don't realize is that unless they are basically already in a good place in life, fame is not going to solve their problems. It's going to bring in a lot more problems. And in fact, it can destroy you. And I think these people were, to some extent, destroyed by their success. If they hadn't have become so successful, maybe they could have worked out their lives in anonymity. But they were destroyed by the very thing that they achieved. But in that self-destruction, of course, I must say, they created some timeless music. All of them did. They were all remarkably talented artists, and that's what we get from them. But they paid the price with their lives.
Howard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Howard Soons. His new book is 27, A History of the 27 Club Through the Lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. As we go out, we'll listen to some Nirvana and Kurt Cobain.
And coming up, a look at what the state legislature passed and left on the table in the session that is just about to end. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Come as you are. Yeah.